I was indignant. We had then, around 12 and a half, a maid who told me all sorts of scandalous tales. I never said a word to Mama, as I was ashamed, but I asked her if sitting on a man's knees could give you a baby. She explained everything as best she could. At school, I learned where babies emerged, and I had the feeling that it was something horrible. But how did they come into the world? We both formed a rather monstrous idea about the thing, especially since one winter morning on the way to school, together in the darkness, we met a certain man who showed us his sexual parts and asked us, "Don't they seem good enough to eat?" Our disgust was inconceivable, and we were literally nauseated. Until I was 21, I thought babies were born through the navel. A little girl took me aside and asked me, "Do you know where babies come from?" Finally, she decided to speak out. "Goodness, how foolish you are. Kids come out of women's stomachs, and for them to be born, women have to do completely disgusting things with men." Then she went into details about how disgusting. But I had become totally transformed, absolutely unable to believe that such things could be possible. We slept in the same room as our parents. One night later, I heard take place what I had thought was impossible. And yes, I was ashamed. I was ashamed of my parents. All of this made of me another being. I went through horrible moral suffering. I considered myself a deeply depraved creature because I was now aware of these things. It should be said that even coherent instruction would not resolve the problem. In spite of the best will of parents and teachers, the sexual experience could not be put into words and concepts. It could only be understood by living it. All analysis, however serious, will have a comic side and will fail to deliver the truth. When, from the poetic loves of flowers to the nuptials of fish, by way of the chick, the cat, or the kid, one reaches the human species, the mystery of conception can be theoretically elucidated. That of voluptuousness and sexual love remains total. How would one explain the pleasure of a caress or a kiss to a dispassionate child? Kisses are given and received in a family way, sometimes even on the lips. Why do these mucus exchanges in certain encounters provoke dizziness? It is like describing colors to the blind. As long as there is no intuition of the excitement and desire that give the sexual function its meaning and unity, the different elements seem shocking and monstrous. In particular, the little girl is revolted when she understands that she is virgin and sealed, and that to change into a woman, a man's sex must penetrate her. Since exhibitionism is a widespread perversion, many little girls have seen the penis in an erection. In any case, they have observed the sexual organs of animals, and it is unfortunate that the horses so often draws their attention. One imagines that they would be frightened by it. Fear of childbirth, fear of the male sex organ, fear of the crises that threaten married couples, disgust for dirty practices, derision for actions devoid of signification, all of this often leads a young girl to declare, "I will never marry." Note: filled with repugnance, I implored God to grant me a religious vocation that would allow me to escape the laws of maternity. And after having long reflected on the repugnant mysteries that I hid in spite of myself, reinforced by such repulsion as by a divine sign, I concluded, "Chastity is certainly my vocation," writes Yasu Gauclair in The Blue Orange. Among others, the idea of perforation horrified her. Here, then, is what makes the wedding night so terrible. This discovery overwhelmed me, adding the physical terror of this operation that I imagined to be extremely painful to the disgust I previously felt. My terror would have been all the worse if I had supposed that birth came about through the same channel, but having known for a long time that children were born from their mother's belly, I believed that they were detached by segmentation. Therein lies the surest defense against pain, folly, and obscenity. It is useless to try to explain that when the day comes, neither deflowering nor childbirth would seem so terrible, that millions of women resign themselves to it and are none the worse for it. When a child fears an outside occurrence, he is relieved of the fear, but not by predicting that, later, he will accept it naturally. It is himself he fears meeting in the far-off future, alienated and lost. The metamorphosis of the caterpillar, through chrysalis and into butterfly, brings about a deep uneasiness. Is it still the same caterpillar after this long sleep? Does she recognize herself beneath these brilliant wings? I knew little girls who were plunged into an alarming reverie at the sight of a chrysalis. And yet, the metamorphosis takes place. The little girl herself does not understand the meaning, but she realizes that in her relations with the world and her own body, something is changing subtly. She is sensitive to contacts, tastes, and odors that previously left her indifferent. Baroque images pass through her head. She barely recognizes herself in mirrors. She feels funny, and things seem funny, such as the case of little Emily, described by Richard Hughes in A High Wind in Jamaica. Emily, for coolness, sat up to her chin in water, and hundreds of infant fish were tickling with their inquisitive mouths every inch of her body, a sort of expressionless light kissing. Anyhow, she had lately come to hate being touched, but this was abominable. At last, when she could stand it no longer, she clambered out and dressed. Even Margaret Kennedy's serene Tessa feels this strange disturbance. Suddenly, she had become intensely miserable. She stared down into the darkness of the hall, cut in two by the moonlight which streamed in through the open door. She could not bear it. She jumped up with a little cry of exasperation. "Oh," she exclaimed, "how I hate it all!" She ran out to hide herself in the mountains, frightened and furious, pursued by a desolate foreboding which seemed to fill the quiet house. As she stumbled up towards the pass, she kept murmuring to herself, "I wish I could die. I wish I was dead." She knew that she did not mean this. She was not in the least anxious to die. But the violence of such a statement seemed to satisfy her. Note, The Constant Nymph, translation. This disturbing moment is described at length in Carson McCullers's previously mentioned book, The Member of the Wedding. This was the summer when Frankie was sick and tired of being Frankie. She hated herself and had become a loafer and a big no-good who hung around the summer kitchen, dirty and greedy and mean and sad. Besides being too mean to live, she was a criminal. Then the spring of that year had been a long, queer season. Things began to change. There was something about the green trees and the flowers of April that made Frankie sad. She did not know why she was sad, but because of this peculiar sadness, she began to realize that she ought to leave the town. She ought to leave the town and go to someplace far away. For the late spring that year was lazy and too sweet. The long afternoons flowered and lasted, and the green sweetness sickened her. Many things made Frankie suddenly wish to cry. Very early in the morning, she would sometimes go out into the yard and stand for a long time looking at the sunrise sky. And it was as though a question came into her heart, and the sky did not answer. Things she had never noticed much before began to hurt her. Home lights watched from the evening sidewalks, an unknown voice from an alley. She would stare at the lights and listen to the voice, and something inside her stiffened and waited. But the lights would darken, the voice fall silent, and though she waited, that was all. She was afraid of these things that made her suddenly wonder who she was and what she was going to be in the world, and why she was standing at that minute, seeing a light, or listening, or staring up into the sky, alone. She was afraid, and there was a queer tightness in her chest. She went around town, and the things she saw and heard seemed to be left somehow unfinished. And there was the tightness in her that would not break. She would hurry to do something, but what she did was always wrong. After the long twilights of this season, when Frankie had walked around the sidewalks of the town, a jazz sadness quivered her nerves, and her heart stiffened and almost stopped. What is happening in this troubled period is that the child's body is becoming a woman's body and being made flesh. Except in the case of glandular deficiency, where the subject remains fixed in the infantile stage, the puberty crisis begins around the age of 12 or 13. Note, These purely physiological processes have already been described in Volume 1, Chapter 1, in Part 1, Destiny, Translation. This crisis begins much earlier for girls than for boys, and it brings about far greater changes. The little girl approaches it with worry and displeasure. As her breasts and body hair develop, a feeling is born that sometimes changes into pride, but begins as shame. Suddenly, the child displays modesty. She refuses to show herself nude, even to her sisters or her mother. She inspects herself with surprise mixed with horror, and she observes with anxiety the swelling of this hard core, somewhat painful, appearing under nipples that until recently were as inoffensive as a navel. She is worried to discover a vulnerable spot in herself. Undoubtedly, this pain is slight compared with a burn or a toothache, but in an accident or illness, pain was always abnormal. While the youthful breast is normally the center of who knows what indefinable resentment. Something is happening, something that is not an illness, but that involves the very law of existence and is yet struggle and suffering. Of course, from birth to puberty, the little girl grew up, but she never felt growth. Day after day, her body was present like an exact finished thing. Now she is developing. The very word horrifies her. Vital phenomena are only reassuring when they have found a balance and taken on the stable aspect of a fresh flower, a polished animal. But in the blossoming of her breasts, the little girl feels the ambiguity of the word living. She is neither gold nor diamond, but a strange matter, moving and uncertain, inside of which impure chemistries develop. She is used to a free-flowing head of hair that falls like a silken skein. But this new growth under her arms, beneath her belly, metamorphoses her into an animal or alga. Whether she is more or less prepared for it, she foresees in these changes a finality that rips her from herself, thus hurled into a vital cycle that goes beyond the moment of her own existence. She senses a dependence that dooms her to man, child, and tomb. In themselves, her breasts seem to be a useless and indiscreet proliferation. Arms, legs, skin, muscles, and even the round buttocks she sits on all have had until now a clear usefulness. Only the sex organ defined as urinary was a bit dubious, though secret and invisible to others. Her breasts show through her sweater or blouse, and this body that the little girl identified with self appears to her as flesh. It is an object that others look at and see. "For 2 years I wore capes to hide my chest. I was so ashamed of it," a woman told me. And another, "I still remember the strange confusion I felt when a friend of my age, but more developed than I was, stooped to pick up a ball. I noticed by the opening in her blouse 2 already heavy breasts. This body so similar to mine, on which my body would be modeled, made me blush for myself. At 13, I walked around bare-legged in a short dress," another woman told me. "A man, sniggering, made a comment about my fat calves. The next day, my mother made me wear stockings and lengthen my skirt. But I will never forget the shock I suddenly felt in seeing myself seen." The little girl feels that her body is escaping her, that it is no longer the clear expression of her individuality. It becomes foreign to her. And at the same moment, she is grasped by others as a thing. On the street, eyes follow her. Her body is subject to comments. She would like to become invisible. She is afraid of becoming flesh and afraid to show her flesh. This disgust is expressed in many young girls by the desire to lose weight. They do not want to eat anymore. If they are forced, they vomit. They watch their weight incessantly. Others become pathologically shy. Entering a room or going out on the street becomes a torture. From these experiences, psychoses sometimes develop. A typical example is Nadia, the patient from Les Obsessions et la Psychasthénie, Obsessions and Psychasthenia, described by Janet. Nadia, a young girl from a wealthy and remarkably intelligent family, was stylish, artistic, and above all, an excellent musician. But from infancy, she was obstinate and irritable. She demanded excessive affection from everyone, her parents, sisters, and servants. But she was so demanding and dominating that she soon alienated people. Horribly susceptible, when her cousins used mockery to try to change her character, she acquired a sense of shame fixed on her body. Then, too, her need for affection made her wish to remain a child, to remain a little girl to be petted, one whose every whim is indulged, and in short made her fear growing up. A precocious puberty worsened her troubles, mixing fears of modesty with fears of growing up. Since men like plump women, I want to remain extremely thin. Pubic hair and growing breasts added to her fears. From the age of 11, as she wore short skirts, it seemed to her that everyone eyed her. She was given long skirts and was then ashamed of her feet, her hips, and so on. The appearance of menstruation drove her half mad, believing that she was the only one in the world having the monstrosity of pubic hair. She labored up to the age of 20 to rid herself of this savage decoration by depilation. The development of breasts exacerbated these obsessions because she had always had a horror of obesity. She did not detest it in others, but for herself, she considered it a defect. "I don't care about being pretty, but I would be too ashamed if I became bloated. That would horrify me. If by bad luck I became fat, I wouldn't dare let anyone see me." So she tried every means, all kinds of prayers and conjurations, to prevent normal growth. She swore to repeat prayers 5 or 10 times, to hop 5 times on 1 foot. "If I touch 1 piano note 4 times in the same piece, I accept growing and not being loved by anyone." Finally, she decided not to eat. "I did not want to get fat, nor to grow up, nor resemble a woman because I always wanted to remain a little girl." She solemnly promised to accept no food at all. When she yielded to her mother's pleas to take some food and broke her vow, she knelt for hours writing out vows and tearing them up. Her mother died when she was 18, and she then imposed a strict regime on herself. 2 clear bouillon soups, an egg yolk, a spoonful of vinegar, a cup of tea with the juice of a whole lemon was all she would take in a day. Hunger devoured her. "Sometimes I spent hours thinking of food. I was so hungry. I swallowed my saliva, gnawed on my handkerchief, and rolled on the floor from wanting to eat." But she resisted temptations. She was pretty, but believed that her face was puffy and covered with pimples. If her doctor stated that he did not see them, she said he didn't understand anything, that he couldn't see the pimples between the skin and the flesh. She left her family in the end and hid in a small apartment, seeing only a guardian and the doctor. She never went out. She accepted her father's visit, but only with difficulty. He brought about a serious relapse by telling her that she looked well. She dreaded having a fat face, healthy complexion, big muscles. She lived most of the time in darkness, so intolerable it was for her to be seen or even visible. Very often, the parent's attitude contributes to inculcating shame in the little girl for her physical appearance. A woman's testimony. "I suffered from a very keen sense of physical inferiority, which was accentuated by continual nagging at home. Mother, in her excessive pride, wanted me to appear at my best, and she always found many faults that required covering up to point out to the dressmaker. For instance, drooping shoulders, heavy hips, too flat in the back, bust too prominent. Having had a swollen neck for years, it was not possible for me to have an open neck," and so on. "I was particularly worried on account of the appearance of my feet, and I was nagged on account of my gait. There was some truth in every criticism, but sometimes I was so embarrassed, particularly during my backfish stage, that at times I was at a loss to know how to move about. If I met someone, my first thought was, if I could only hide my feet." Note, Stekel, Frigidity in Woman. This shame makes the girl act awkwardly, blush at the drop of a hat. This blushing increases her timidity, and itself becomes the object of a phobia. Stekel recounts, among others, a woman who, as a young girl, blushed so pathologically and violently that for a year she wore bandages around her face with the excuse of toothaches. Sometimes, in pre-puberty, preceding the arrival of her period, the girl does not yet feel disgust for her body. She is proud of becoming a woman. She eagerly awaits her maturing breasts, She pads her blouse with handkerchiefs and brags around her older sisters. She does not yet grasp the meaning of the phenomena taking place in her. Her first period exposes this meaning, and feelings of shame appear. If they existed already, they are confirmed and magnified from this moment on. All the accounts agree, whether or not the child has been warned, the event always appears repugnant and humiliating. The mother very often neglected to warn her. It has been noted that mothers explain the mysteries of pregnancy, childbirth, and even sexual relations to their daughters more easily than that of menstruation. They themselves hate this feminine servitude, a hatred that reflects men's old mystical terrors and one that they transmit to their offspring. Note: refer to the works of Daly and Chadwick, cited by Deutsch in Psychology of Women, 1946. When the girl finds suspicious stains on her underwear, she thinks she has diarrhea, a fatal hemorrhage, a venereal disease. According to a survey that Havelock Ellis cited in 1896, out of 125 American high school students, 36 at the time of their first period knew absolutely nothing on the question. 39 had vague ideas. That is, more than half of the girls were unaware. And according to Helena Deutsch, things had not changed much by 1946. Ellis cites the case of a young girl who threw herself into the Seine in Saint-Ouen because she thought she had an unknown disease. Stekel, in Letters to a Mother, tells the story of a little girl who tried to commit suicide, seeing in the menstrual flow the sign of and punishment for the impurities that sullied her soul. It is natural for the young girl to be afraid. It seems to her that her life is seeping out of her. According to Klein and the English psychoanalytic school, blood is for the young girl the manifestation of a wound of the internal organs. Even if cautious advice saves her from excessive anxiety, she is ashamed, she feels dirty, she rushes to the sink, she tries to wash or hide her dirtied underwear. There is a typical account of the experience in Colette Audry's book, In the Eyes of Memory. At the heart of this exaltation, the brutal and finished drama. One evening, while getting undressed, I thought I was sick. It did not frighten me, and I kept myself from saying anything in the hope that it would disappear the next day. 4 weeks later, the illness occurred again, but more violently. I was quietly going to throw my knickers into the hamper behind the bathroom door. It was so hot that the diamond-shaped tiles of the hallway were warm under my naked feet. When I then got into bed, Mama opened my bedroom door. She came to explain things to me. I am unable to remember the effect her words had on me at that time, but while she was whispering, Kaki poked her head in. The sight of this round and curious face drove me crazy. I screamed at her to get out of there, and she disappeared in fright. I begged Mama to go and beat her because she hadn't knocked before entering. My mother's calmness, her knowing and quietly happy air, were all it took to make me lose my head. When she left, I dug myself in for a stormy night. Two memories all of a sudden come back. A few months earlier, coming back from a walk with Kaki, Mama and I had met the old doctor from Priva, built like a logger with a full white beard. "Your daughter is growing up, madame," he said while looking at me, and I hated him right then and there without understanding anything. A little later, coming back from Paris, Mama put away some new little towels in the chest of drawers. "What is that?" Kaki asked. Mama had this natural air of adult to reveal one part of the truth while omitting the other three. "It's for Colette soon." Speechless, unable to utter one question, I hated my mother. That whole night I tossed and turned in my bed. It was not possible. I was going to wake up. Mama was mistaken. It would go away and not come back again. The next day, secretly changed and stained, I had to confront the others. I looked at my sister with hatred because she did not yet know, because all of a sudden she found herself, unknown to her, endowed with an overwhelming superiority over me. Then I began to hate men, who would never experience this, and who knew. And then I also hated women who accepted it so calmly. I was sure that if they had been warned of what was happening to me, they would all be overjoyed. "So it's your turn now," they would have thought. "That one, too. I said to myself when I saw one, and this one, too. I was had by the world. I had trouble walking and didn't dare run. The earth, the sun-hot greenery, even the food, seemed to give off a suspicious smell. The crisis passed, and I began to hope against hope that it would not come back again. 1 month later, I had to face the facts and accept the evil definitively, in a heavy stupor this time. There was now in my memory a before. All the rest of my existence would no longer be anything but an after. Things happen in a similar way for most little girls. Many of them are horrified at the idea of sharing their secret with those around them. A friend told me that, motherless, she lived between her father and a primary school teacher and spent 3 months in fear and shame, hiding her stained underwear before it was discovered that she had begun menstruating. Even peasant women who might be expected to be hardened by their knowledge of the harshest sides of animal life are horrified by this malediction, which in the countryside is still taboo. I knew a young woman farmer who washed her underwear in secret in the frozen brook, putting her soaking garment directly back on her naked skin to hide her unspeakable secret. I could cite 100 similar facts. Even admitting this astonishing misfortune offers no relief. Undoubtedly, the mother who slapped her daughter brutally, saying, "Stupid! You're much too young," is exceptional. But this is not only about being in a bad mood. Most mothers fail to give the child the necessary explanations, and so she is full of anxiety before this new state brought about by the first menstruation crisis. She wonders if the future does not hold other painful surprises for her, or else she imagines that from now on she could become pregnant by the simple presence or contact with a man, and she feels real terror of males. Even if she is spared these anxieties by intelligent explanations, she is not so easily granted peace of mind. Prior to this, the girl could, with a little bad faith, still think herself an asexual being. She could just not think herself. She even dreams of waking up one morning changed into a man. These days, mothers and aunts flatter and whisper to each other, "She's a big girl now." The Brotherhood of Matrons has won. She belongs to them. Here she takes her place on the women's side without recourse. Sometimes she is proud of it. She thinks she has now become an adult, and an upheaval will occur in her existence. As Tide Monnier recounts, "Some of us had become big girls during vacation. Others would while at school, and then one after the other in the toilets in the courtyard, where they were sitting on their thrones like queens receiving their subjects, we would go and see the blood." Note, moi, me. But the girl is soon disappointed because she sees that she has not gained any privilege and that life follows its normal course. The only novelty is the disgusting event repeated monthly. There are children that cry for hours when they learn they are condemned to this destiny. What adds to their revolt is that this shameful defect is known by men as well. What they would like is that the humiliating feminine condition at least be shrouded in mystery for them. But no, father, brothers, cousins, men know and even joke about it sometimes. This is when the shame of her too carnal body is born or exacerbated. And once the first surprise has passed, the monthly unpleasantness does not fade away at all. Each time the girl finds the same disgust when faced by this unappetizing and stagnant odor that comes from herself, a smell of swamps and wilted violets, this less red and more suspicious blood than that flowing from children's cuts and scratches. Day and night she has to think of changing her protection, watching her underwear, her sheets, and solving 1,000 little practical and repugnant problems. In thrifty families, sanitary napkins are washed each month and take their place among the piles of handkerchiefs. This waste coming out of oneself has to be delivered to those handling the laundry, the laundress, servant, mother, or older sister. The types of bandages pharmacies sell in boxes named after flowers, camellia or edelweiss, are thrown out after use, but while traveling, on vacation, or on a trip, it is not so easy to get rid of them, the toilet bowl being specifically prohibited. The young heroine of the Psychoanalytical Journal described her horror of the sanitary napkin. Note, translated by Clara Malraux. She did not even consent to undress in front of her sister, except in the dark during these times. This bothersome, annoying object can come loose during violent exercise. It is a worse humiliation than losing one's knickers in the middle of the street. This horrid possibility sometimes brings about fits of psychasthenia. By a kind of ill will of nature, indisposition and pain often do not begin until the initial bleeding, often hardly noticed, has passed. Young girls are often irregular. They might be surprised during a walk, in the street, at friends. They risk, like Madame de Chevreuse, dirtying their clothes or their seat. Such a possibility makes one live in constant anxiety. Note, disguised as a man during the Fronde, Madame de Chevreuse, after a long excursion on horseback, was unmasked because of bloodstain seen on the saddle. The greater the young girl's feeling of revulsion toward this feminine defect, the greater her obligation to pay careful attention to it so as not to expose herself to the awful humiliation of an accident or a little word of warning. Here is the series of answers that Dr. Liebmann obtained during his study of juvenile sexuality. At 16 years of age, when I was indisposed for the first time, I was very frightened in seeing it one morning. In truth, I knew it was going to happen, but I was so ashamed of it that I remained in bed for a whole half day and had one answer to all questions. I cannot get up. I was speechless in astonishment when, not yet 12, I was indisposed for the first time. I was struck by horror, and as my mother limited herself to telling me dryly that this would happen every month, I considered it something disgusting and refused to accept that this did not also happen to men. This adventure made my mother decide to initiate me without forgetting menstruation at the same time. I then had my second disappointment because as soon as I was indisposed, I ran joyfully to my mother, who was still sleeping, and I woke her up shouting, "Mother, I have it!" "And that is why you woke me up?" she managed to say in response. In spite of everything, I considered this thing a real upheaval in my existence. And so I felt the most intense horror when I was indisposed for the first time, seeing that the bleeding did not stop after a few minutes. Nevertheless, I did not whisper a word to anyone, not to my mother either. I had just reached the age of 15. In addition, I suffered very little. Only one time was I taken with such terrifying pain that I fainted and stayed on the floor in my room for almost 3 hours. But I still did not say anything to anyone. When for the first time this indisposition occurred, I was about 13. My school friends and I had already talked about it, and I was proud to finally become one of the big girls. With great importance, I explained to the gym teacher that it was impossible today for me to take part in the lesson because I was indisposed. It was not my mother who initiated me. It was not until the age of 19 that she had her period, and for fear of being scolded for dirtying her underwear, she buried it in a field. I reached the age of 18, and I then had my period for the first time. I was totally unprepared for what was happening. At night, I had violent bleeding accompanied by heavy diarrhea, and I could not rest for one second. In the morning, my heart racing, I ran to my mother and, weeping constantly, asked her advice. But I only obtained this harsh reprimand. "You should have been aware of it sooner and not have dirtied the sheets in bed." That was all, as far as explanation was concerned. Naturally, I tried very hard to know what crime I might have committed, and I suffered terrible anguish. Note, she was a girl from a very poor Berlin family. I already knew what it was. I was waiting for it impatiently because I was hoping my mother would reveal to me how children were made. The celebrated day arrived, but my mother remained silent. Nevertheless, I was joyous. "From now on," I said to myself, "you can make children. You are a lady." Note, Dr. W. Liebmann, Youth and Sexuality. This crisis takes place at a still tender age. The boy only reaches adolescence at about 15 or 16. The girl changes into a woman at 13 or 14. But the essential difference in their experience does not stem from there, nor does it lie in the physiological manifestations that give it its awful shock in the case of the girl. Puberty has a radically different meaning for the two sexes because it does not announce the same future to them. Granted, boys too at puberty feel their body as an embarrassing presence, but because they have been proud of their virility from childhood, it is toward that virility that they proudly transcend the moment of their development. They proudly exhibit the hair growing between their legs and that makes men of them. More than ever, their sex is an object of comparison and challenge. Becoming adults is an intimidating metamorphosis. Many adolescents react with anxiety to a demanding freedom, but they accede to the dignified status of male with joy. On the contrary, to become a grown-up, the girl must confine herself within the limits that her femininity imposes on her. The boy admires undefined promises in the growing hair. She remains confused before the brutal and finished drama that limits her destiny. Just as the penis gets its privileged value from the social context makes menstruation a malediction. One symbolizes virility and the other femininity. It is because femininity means alterity and inferiority that its revelation is met with shame. The girl's life has always appeared to her to be determined by this impalpable essence to which the absence of the penis has not managed to give a positive image. It is this essence that is revealed in the red flow that escapes from between her thighs. If she has already assumed her condition, she welcomes the event with joy. Now you are a lady. If she has always refused it, the bloody verdict strikes her like lightning. Most often she hesitates. The menstrual stain inclines her toward disgust and fear. So this is what these words mean, being a woman. The fate that until now has weighed on her ambivalently and from the outside is lodged in her belly. There is no escape. She feels trapped. In a sexually egalitarian society, she would envisage menstruation only as her unique way of acceding to an adult life. The human body has many other more repugnant servitudes in men and women. They easily make the best of them because as they are common to all, they do not represent a flaw for anyone. Menstrual periods inspire horror in adolescent girls because they thrust them into an inferior and damaged category. This feeling of degradation will weigh heavily on the girl. She would retain the pride of her bleeding body if she did not lose her self-respect as a human being. And if she succeeds in preserving her self-respect, she will feel the humiliation of her flesh much less vividly. The girl who opens paths of transcendence in sports, social, intellectual, and mystical activities will not see a mutilation in her specificity, and she will overcome it easily. If the young girl often develops psychoses in this period, it is because she feels defenseless in front of a deaf fate that condemns her to unimaginable trials. Her femininity signifies illness, suffering, and death in her eyes, and she is transfixed by this destiny. One example that vividly illustrates these anxieties is that of the patient called Molly, described by Helena Deutsch. Molly was 14 when she began to suffer from psychic disorders. She was the fourth child in a family of five siblings. Her father is described as extremely strict and narrow-minded. He criticized the appearance and behavior of his children at every meal. The mother was worried and unhappy, and every so often the parents were not on speaking terms. One brother ran away from home. The patient was a gifted youngster, a good tap dancer, but she was shy, took the family troubles seriously, and was afraid of boys. Her older sister got married against her mother's wishes, and Molly was very interested in her pregnancy. She had a difficult delivery, and forceps were necessary, and she heard that women often die in childbirth. She took care of the baby for 2 months. When the sister left the house, there was a terrible scene, and the mother fainted. Molly fainted too. She had seen classmates faint in class, and her thoughts were much concerned with death and fainting. When she got her period, she told her mother with an embarrassed air, "That thing is here." She went with her sister to buy some menstrual pads. On meeting a man in the street, she hung her head. In general, she acted disgusted with herself. She never had pain during her periods, but tried to hide them from her mother, even when the latter saw stains on the sheets. She told her sister, "Anything might happen to me now. I might have a baby. When told, you have to live with a man for that to happen, she replied. Well, I am living with two men, my father and your husband. The father did not permit his daughters to go out because one heard stories of rape. These fears helped to give Molly the idea of men being redoubtable creatures. From her first menstruation, her anxiety about becoming pregnant and dying in childbirth became so severe that after a time she refused to leave her room, and now she sometimes stays in bed all day. If she has to go out of the house, she has an attack and faints. She is afraid of cars and taxis, and she cannot sleep. She fears that someone is trying to enter the house at night. She screams and cries. She has eating spells. Sometimes she eats too much to keep herself from fainting. She is also afraid when she feels closed in. She cannot go to school anymore or lead a normal life. A similar story, not linked to the crisis of menstruation, but which shows the girl's anxiety about her insides, is Nancy's. Toward the age of 13, the little girl was on intimate terms with her older sister, and she had been proud to be in her confidence when the sister was secretly engaged and then married, to share the secret of a grown-up was to be accepted among the adults. She lived for a time with her sister, but when the latter told her that she was going to buy a baby, Nancy got jealous of her brother-in-law and of the coming child. To be treated again as a child to whom one made little mysteries of things was unbearable. She began to experience internal troubles and wanted to be operated on for appendicitis. The operation was a success, but during her stay at the hospital, Nancy lived in a state of severe agitation. She made violent scenes with a nurse she disliked. She tried to seduce the doctor, making dates with him, being provocative and demanding throughout her crises to be treated as a woman. She accused herself of being to blame for the death of a little brother some years before. And in particular, she felt sure that they had not removed her appendix or had left a part of it inside her. Her claim that she had swallowed a penny was probably intended to make sure an X-ray would be taken. Note, cited also by Helena Deutsch, Psychology of Women. This desire for an operation, and in particular for the removal of the appendix, is often seen at this age. Girls thus express their fear of rape, pregnancy, or having a baby. They feel in their womb obscure perils and hope that the surgeon will save them from this unknown and threatening danger. It is not only the arrival of her period that signals to the girl her destiny as a woman. Other dubious phenomena occur in her. Until then, her eroticism was clitoral. It is difficult to know if solitary sexual practices are less widespread in girls than in boys. The girl indulges in them in her first 2 years, and perhaps even in the first months of her life. It seems that she stops at about 2 before taking them up again later. Because of his anatomical makeup, this stem planted in the male flesh asks to be touched more than a secret mucous membrane. But the chances of rubbing, the child climbing on a gym apparatus or on trees or onto a bicycle, of contact with clothes, or in a game, or even initiation by friends, older friends or adults, frequently make the girl discover sensations she tries to renew. In any case, pleasure, when reached, is an autonomous sensation. It has the lightness and innocence of all childish amusements. Note, except, of course, in numerous cases where the direct or indirect intervention of the parents or religious scruples make a sin of it. Little girls have sometimes been subjected to abominable persecutions under the pretext of saving them from bad habits. As a child, she hardly established a relation between these intimate delights and her destiny as a woman. Her sexual relations with boys, if there were any, were essentially based on curiosity. And all of a sudden, she experiences emotional confusion in which she does not recognize herself. Sensitivity of the erogenous zones is developing, and they are so numerous in the woman that her whole body can be considered erogenous. This is what comes across from familial caresses, innocent kisses, the casual touching of a dressmaker, a doctor, a hairdresser, or a friendly hand on her hair or neck. She learns, and often deliberately seeks, a deeper excitement in her relations of play and fighting with boys or girls. Thus, Gilberte, fighting on the Champs-Élysées with Proust. In the arms of her dancing partners, under her mother's naive eyes, she experiences a strange lassitude. And then, even a well-protected young woman is exposed to more specific experiences. In conventional circles, regrettable incidents are hushed up by common agreement. But it often happens that some of the caresses of friends of the household, uncles, cousins, not to mention grandfathers and fathers, are much less inoffensive than the mother thinks. A professor, a priest, or a doctor was bold, indiscreet. Such experiences are found in The Prison of Her Skin by Violette Leduc, in Maternal Hatred by Simone de Tervagne, and in The Blue Orange by Yasu Gauclair. Stekel thinks that grandfathers in particular are often very dangerous. I was 15, the night before the funeral. My grandfather came to sleep at our house. The next day, my mother was already up. He asked me if he could get into bed with me to play. I got up immediately without answering him. I began to be afraid of men, a woman recounted. Another girl recalled receiving a serious shock at 8 or 10 years of age when her grandfather, an old man of 60, had groped her genitals. He had taken her on his lap while sliding his finger into her vagina. The child had felt an immense anxiety, but yet did not dare talk about it. Since that time, she has been very afraid of everything sexual. Note, frigidity in woman. Such incidents are usually endured in silence by the little girl because of the shame they cause. Moreover, if she does reveal them to her parents, their reaction is often to reprimand her. Don't say such stupid things. You've got an evil mind. She is also silent about bizarre activities of some strangers. A little girl told Dr. Liebmann. We had rented a room from the shoemaker in the basement. Often when our landlord was alone, he came to get me, took me in his arms, and kissed me for a long time, all the while wiggling back and forth. His kiss wasn't superficial, besides, since he stuck his tongue into my mouth. I detested him because of his ways, but I never whispered a word, as I was very fearful. Note, Liebmann, Youth and Sexuality. In addition to enterprising companions and perverse girlfriends, there is this knee in the cinema pressed against the girls, this hand at night in the train, sliding along her leg, these boys who sniggered when she passed, these men who followed her in the street, these embraces, these furtive touches. She does not really understand the meaning of these adventures. In the 15-year-old head, there is often a strange confusion because theoretical knowledge and concrete experiences do not match. She has already felt all the burnings of excitement and desire, but she imagines, like Clara de la Beuse, invented by Francis Jammes, that a male kiss is enough to make her a mother. She has a clear idea of the genital anatomy, but when her dancing partner embraces her, she thinks the agitation she feels is a migraine. It is certain that girls are better informed today than in the past. However, some psychiatrists affirm that there is more than one adolescent girl who does not know that sexual organs have a use other than urinary. Note, refer to H. Deutsch, Psychology of Women. In any case, girls do not draw much connection between their sexual agitation and the existence of their genital organs, since there is no sign as precise as the male erection indicating this correlation. There is such a gap between the romantic musings concerning man and love and the crudeness of certain facts that are revealed to them that they do not create any link between them. Tide Monnier relates that she had made the pledge with a few girlfriends to see how a man was made and to tell it to the others. Having entered my father's room on purpose without knocking, I described it. It looks like a leg of lamb, that is, it is like a rolling pin, and then there is a round thing. It was difficult to explain. I drew it. I even did it 3 times, and each one took hers away, hidden in her blouse, and from time to time she burst out laughing while looking at it, and then went all dreamy. How could innocent girls like us set up a connection between these objects and sentimental songs, pretty little romantic stories where love as a whole, respect, shyness, sighs, and kissing of the hand, is sublimated to the point of making a eunuch. Note, me. Nevertheless, through reading, conversations, theater, and words she has overheard, the girl gives meaning to the disturbances of her flesh. She becomes appeal and desire. In her fevers, shivers, dampness, and uncertain states, her body takes on a new and unsettling dimension. The young man is proud of his sexual propensities because he assumes his virility joyfully. Sexual desire is aggressive and prehensile for him. There is an affirmation of his subjectivity and transcendence in it. He boasts of it to his friends. His sex organ is for him a disturbance he takes pride in. The drive that sends him toward the female is of the same nature as that which throws him toward the world, and so he recognizes himself in it. On the contrary, the girl's sexual life has always been hidden. When her eroticism is transformed and invades her whole flesh, the mystery becomes agonizing. She undergoes the disturbance as a shameful illness. It is not active. It is a state. And even in imagination, she cannot get rid of it by any autonomous decision. She does not dream of taking, pressing, violating. She is weight and appeal. She feels dependent. She feels herself at risk in her alienated flesh. Her diffuse hope and her dream of happy passivity clearly reveal her body as an object destined for another. She seeks to know sexual experience only in its imminence. It is the contact of the hand, mouth, or another flesh that she desires. The image of her partner is left in the shadows, or she drowns it in an idealized haze. However, she cannot prevent his presence from haunting her. Her terrors and juvenile revulsions regarding man have assumed a more equivocal character than before, and because of that, they are more agonizing. Before, they stemmed from a profound divorce between the child's organism and her future as an adult. Now they come from this very complexity that the girl feels in her flesh. She understands that she is destined for possession because she wants it, and she revolts against her desires. She at once wishes for and fears the shameful passivity of the consenting prey. She is overwhelmed with confusion at the idea of bearing herself before a man, but she also senses that she will then be given over to his gaze without recourse. The hand that takes and that touches has an even more imperious presence than do eyes. It is more frightening. But the most obvious and detestable symbol of physical possession is penetration by the male sex organ. The girl hates the idea that this body she identifies with may be perforated as one perforates leather, that it can be torn as one tears a piece of fabric. But the girl refuses more than the wound and the accompanying pain. She refuses that these be inflicted. The idea of being pierced by a man is horrible, a girl told me one day. It is not fear of the virile member that engenders horror of the man, but this fear is the confirmation and symbol. The idea of penetration acquires its obscene and humiliating meaning within a more generalized form, of which it is in turn an essential element. The girl's anxiety shows itself in nightmares that torment her and fantasies that haunt her. Just when she feels an insidious complacence in herself, the idea of rape becomes obsessive in many cases. It manifests itself in dreams and behavior in the form of many more or less obvious symbols. The girl explores her room before going to bed for fear of finding some robber with shady intentions. She thinks she hears thieves in the house. An aggressor comes in through the window armed with a knife, and he stabs her. In a more or less acute way, men inspire terror in her. She begins to feel a certain disgust for her father. She can no longer stand the smell of his tobacco. She detests going into the bathroom after him. Even if she continues to cherish him, this physical revulsion is frequent. It takes on an intensified form if the child was already hostile to her father, as often happens in the youngest children. A dream often encountered by psychiatrists in their young female patients is that they imagine being raped by a man in front of an older woman and with her consent. It is clear that they are symbolically asking their mother for permission to give in to their desires. That is because one of the most detestable constraints weighing on them is that of hypocrisy. The girl is dedicated to purity, to innocence, at precisely the moment she discovers in and around her the mysterious disturbances of life and sex. She has to be white like an ermine, transparent like crystal. She is dressed in vaporous organdy. Her room is decorated with candy-colored hangings. People lower their voices when she approaches. She is prohibited from seeing indecent books. Yet there is not one child on earth who does not relish abominable images and desires. She tries to hide them from her best friend, even from herself. She only wants to live or to think by the rules. Her self-defiance gives her a devious, unhappy, and sickly look, and later, nothing will be harder than combating these inhibitions. But in spite of all these repressions, she feels oppressed by the weight of unspeakable faults. Her metamorphosis into a woman takes place not only in shame, but in remorse for suffering that shame. We understand that the awkward age is a period of painful distress for the girl. She does not want to remain a child, but the adult world seems frightening or boring to her. Colette Audry says, "So I wanted to grow up, but never did I seriously dream of leading the life I saw adults lead. And thus the desire to grow up without ever assuming an adult state, without ever feeling solidarity with parents, mistresses of the house, housewives, or heads of family, was forming in me." She would like to free herself from her mother's yoke, but she also has an ardent need for her protection. The faults that weigh on her consciousness, solitary sexual practices, dubious friendships, improper books, make this refuge necessary. The following letter, written to a girlfriend by a 15-year-old girl, is typical. "Mother wants me to wear a long dress at the big dance party at W's, my first long dress. She is surprised that I do not want to. I begged her to let me wear my short pink dress for the last time. I'm so afraid. This long dress makes me feel as if Mummy were going on a long trip and I did not know when she would. Isn't that silly? And sometimes she looks at me as though I were still a little girl. Ah, if she knew, she would tie my hands to the bed and despise me." Note, quoted by Helena Deutsch, Psychology of Women. Stekel's book, Frigidity in Woman, is a remarkable document on female childhood. In it, a Viennese Zuse Mädel wrote a detailed confession at about the age of 21. Note, Zuse Mädel, Sweet Girl, translation. It is a concrete synthesis of all the moments we have studied separately. "At the age of 5, I chose for my playmate, Richard, a boy of 6 or 7. For a long time, I had wanted to know how one can tell whether a child is a girl or a boy. I was told, by the earrings or by the nose. This seemed to satisfy me, though I had a feeling that they were keeping something from me. Suddenly, Richard expressed a desire to urinate. Then the thought came to me of lending him my chamber pot. When I saw his organ, which was something entirely new to me, I went into highest raptures. 'What have you there? My, isn't that nice? I'd like to have something like that too.' Whereupon I took hold of the membrum and held it enthusiastically. My great aunt's cough awoke us, and from that day on our doings and games were carefully watched. At 9, she played marriage and doctor with 2 other boys of 8 and 10. They touched her parts, and one day one of the boys touched her with his organ, saying that her parents had done just the same thing when they got married. This aroused my indignation. 'Oh, no, they never did such a nasty thing.' She kept up these games for a long time in a strong sexual friendship with the 2 boys. One day her aunt caught her, and there was a frightful scene with threats to put her in the reformatory. She was prevented from seeing Arthur, whom she preferred, and she suffered a good deal from it. Her work went badly, her writing was deformed, and she became cross-eyed. She started another intimacy with Walter and Franz. Walter became the goal of all thoughts and feeling. I permitted him very submissively to reach under my dress while I sat or stood in front of him at the table, pretending to be busy with a writing exercise. Whenever my mother opened the door, he withdrew his hand on the instant. I, of course, was busy writing. In the course of time, we also behaved as husband and wife, but I never allowed him to stay long. Whenever he thought he was inside me, I tore myself away, saying that somebody was coming. I did not reflect that this was sinful. My childhood boy friendships were now over. All I had left were girlfriends. I attached myself to Emmy, a highly refined, well-educated girl. One Christmas, we exchanged gilded heart-shaped lockets with our initials engraved on them. We were, I believe, about 12 years of age at the time. And we looked upon this as a token of engagement. We swore eternal faithfulness until death do us part. I owe to Emmy a goodly part of my training. She taught me also a few things regarding sexual matters. As far back as during my fifth grade at school, I began seriously to doubt the veracity of the stork story. I thought that children developed within the body and that the abdomen must be cut open before a child can be brought out. She filled me with particular horror of self-abuse. In school, the Gospels contributed a share towards opening our eyes with regard to certain sexual matters. For instance, when Mary came to Elizabeth, the child is said to have leaped in her womb. And we read other similarly remarkable Bible passages. We underscored these words, and when this was discovered, the whole class barely escaped a black mark in deportment. My girlfriend told me also about the ninth-month reminder, to which there is a reference in Schiller's The Robbers. Emmy's father moved from our locality, and I was again alone. We corresponded, using for the purpose a cryptic alphabet which we had devised between ourselves. But I was lonesome, and finally I attached myself to Hadel, a Jewish girl. Once Emmy caught me leaving school in Hadel's company, she created a scene on account of her jealousy. I kept up my friendship with Hadel until I entered the commercial school. We became close friends. We both dreamed of becoming sisters-in-laws sometimes because I was fond of one of her brothers. He was a student. Whenever he spoke to me, I became so confused that I gave him an irrelevant answer. At dusk, we sat in the music room, huddled together on the little divan, and often tears rolled down my cheek for no particular reason as he played the piano. Before I befriended Hadel, I went to school for a number of weeks with a certain girl, Ella, the daughter of poor people. Once she caught her parents in a tête-à-tête. The creaking of the bed had awakened her. She came and told me that her father had crawled on top of her mother and that the mother had cried out terribly, and then the father said to her mother, "Go quickly and wash so that nothing will happen." After this, I was angry at her father and avoided him on the street, while for her mother, I felt the greatest sympathy. He must have hurt her terribly if she cried out so. Again, with another girl, I discussed the possible length of the male membrane. I had heard that it was 12 to 15 centimeters long. During the fancy work period at school, we took the tape measure and indicated the stated length on our stomachs, naturally reaching to the navel. This horrified us. If we should ever marry, we would be literally impaled. She saw a male dog excited by the proximity of a female and felt strange stirrings inside herself. If I saw a horse urinate in the street, my eyes were always glued to the wet spot in the road. I believe the length of time, urinating, is what always impressed me. She watched flies in copulation and in the country, domesticated animals doing the same. At 12, I suffered a severe attack of tonsillitis. A friendly physician was called in. He seated himself on my bed, and presently he stuck his hand under the covers, almost touching me on the genitalia. I exclaimed, "Don't be so rude!" My mother hurried in. The doctor was much embarrassed. He declared I was a horrid monkey, saying he merely wanted to pinch me on the calf. I was compelled to ask his forgiveness. When I finally began to menstruate, and my father came across the blood-stained cloths on one occasion, there was a terrible scene. How did it happen that he, so clean a man, had to live among such dirty females? I felt the injustice of being put in the wrong on account of my menstruation. At 15, she communicated with another girl in shorthand, so that no one else could decipher our missives. There was much to report about conquests. She copied for me a vast number of verses from the walls of lavatories. I took particular notice of one. It seemed to me that love, which ranged so high in my fantasy, was being dragged in the mud by it. The verse read, "What is love's highest aim? Four buttocks on a stem." I decided I would never get into that situation. A man who loves a young girl would be unable to ask such a thing of her. At 15 and a half, I had a new brother. I was tremendously jealous, for I had always been the only child in the family. My friend reminded me to observe how the baby boy was constructed, but with the best intentions, I was unable to give her the desired information. I could not look there. At about this time, another girl described to me a bridal night scene. I think that then I made up my mind to marry after all, for I was very curious. Only the panting like a horse, as mentioned in the description, offended my aesthetic sense. Which one of us girls would not have gladly married then to undress before the beloved and be carried to bed in his arms? It seemed so thrilling. It will perhaps be said, even though this is a normal and not a pathological case, that this child was exceptionally perverse. She was only less watched over than others. If the curiosities and desires of well-bred girls do not manifest themselves in acts, they nonetheless exist in the form of fantasies and games. I once knew a very pious and disconcertingly innocent girl who became an accomplished woman, devoted to maternity and religion, who one evening confided all trembling to an older woman, "How marvelous it must be to get undressed in front of a man. Let's suppose you are my husband." And she began to undress, all trembling with emotion. No upbringing can prevent the girl from becoming aware of her body and dreaming of her destiny. The most one can do is to impose strict repression that will then weigh on her for her whole sexual life. What would be desirable is that she be taught, on the contrary, to accept herself without excuses and without shame. One understands now the drama that rends the adolescent girl at puberty. She cannot become a grown-up without accepting her femininity. She already knew her sex condemned her to a mutilated and frozen existence. She now discovers it in the form of an impure illness and an obscure crime. Her inferiority was at first understood as a privation. The absence of a penis